2018 was dubbed the year of the CVA, as so many major high street names sought recourse to company voluntary arrangements in a bid to cut key costs, not least rent, and keep the doors open. A couple of months in, 2019 is following in last year's footsteps. Only the day before this recording, EG reported on CVA proposals put forward by Paper Jace and by restaurant chains Giraffe and Ed's Easy Diner. More, inevitably it seems, will follow. But what are the legal implications of all this, and does the CVA process strike a fair balance between struggling retail tenants and their landlords? I'm Jess Harold, EG's Deputy Legal Editor, and here to discuss this with me are Matthew Bonney and John Chetwood from law firm Herbert Smith Freehills. Matthew is Head of Real Estate Disputes, and John is a Senior Associate in the Restructuring and Insolvency team. They've both been kept very busy by the developments in this area over recent months, and indeed years. Welcome to you both, and please take an opportunity now to introduce yourselves so that listeners can try to keep track of who is speaking.
Hello, I'm Matthew Bonney. My practice is spread right across working with High Court cases, dealing with tribunals, and dealing with matters which may only be on the horizon for some of our clients. But that may include buying properties where there are retail units, and that can be very relevant to what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm.
And my name is John Chetwood. I'm a senior associate in the restructuring insolvency team. I come at this very much from the restructuring background. I've worked across all sectors, not just real estate, and we're obviously very familiar with the use of CVAs in the leasehold sector.
Okay, so first off, for anyone listening who has been scrupulously avoiding our extensive CVA coverage for the last year and a bit, can you outline how this procedure typically works for a struggling retailer?
Yes, of course. A CVA is ultimately a compromise that is an alternative to administration or liquidation. It's the company that is responsible for issuing a proposal to its creditors. And in the high street context, often the only creditors who would be affected are landlords. The process then follows that creditors, having received the proposal, are invited to vote on it. If the proposal is approved by at least 75% in value of creditors present and voting, the proposal then becomes binding on all creditors. And the beauty of a CVA from a company perspective is once the CVA has been approved by that majority of creditors, the proposal can only be challenged on very specific grounds that are set out in the Insolvency Act and within a very strict 28-day limit.
And what does that end up typically meaning for landlords, particularly those with large portfolios of affected stores?
So for landlords, it very much varies by store. So the usual approach for most CVA proposals is to distinguish between various categories of stores and apply different compromises to those stores. So in the best case, if a store is in the best category, the only change might be to move rent to a monthly basis from a quarterly basis. In the worst case, a landlord may find that the terms of the CVA impose a compromise, reducing the rent potentially from, you know, after an initial lump sum or an initial period to zero. And we've also seen instances of tenants seeking to use CVAs to ultimately pass the rates liability to landlords. For landlords with a broad variety, with a broad portfolio of stores, they're likely to find that their stores are spread out amongst various different categories, so they've got various different treatment to each of their stores in the same proposals. And one of the other points for landlords to consider is that a CVA is not itself an indicator of financial health. So there may be a question mark for the landlord as to the long-term viability of that tenant and whether that tenant is the right occupier for the store in that centre.
And I'm sure sort of all the a number of small reductions across different stores can amount to quite significant sums when looking across a large portfolio cumulatively.
I think that's right. And what the market has seen recently is the fact that actually there have been so many CVAs that as a problem and as a scale of a problem for the industry, it has become more significant because there have been so many more tenants who've sought to propose these CVAs.
And Matthew, what legal remedies are available for landlords in this situation?
Well, it's worth just reminding ourselves of what the legal remedies would otherwise be. If there wasn't a CVA, then typically if a landlord wants to keep the tenant, then they will tend to avoid going near forfeiture because that's a handy threat. Because if the tenant wants to stay, then it would want to avoid having its lease forfeited. But in situations where tenants may be wanting to get rid of some of their units, then forfeiture is probably not a huge threat for the landlord, and the risk is that the landlord simply cuts off what would otherwise be an income stream. So we're usually talking about debt recovery. That can be the county court in the form of a county court claim. With the rent, you can quite often serve a statutory demand and then follow that up with winding up petition. So those kind of avenues are usually available. But in a CVA, the rent due under the lease will be amended and there will be a contractual moratorium. So those usual remedies are not available. And usually what has to happen if a landlord does want to attempt them is that the landlord has to come in very quick before the CVA comes into effect. Sometimes those steps are possible, but equally it's not a reliable route to take. So really the only remedy is to seek to challenge the CVA under one of those limited statutory grounds, or wait to see if the tenant abides by its terms, which isn't really a solution. All we're saying is then that the landlord has to accept what it's given. Conceivably, the landlord may want to take a surrender if the tenant is willing to offer this. For example, there might be a surrender trigger provision in the CVA, which is one of the things which would then allow the landlord effectively to take the premises back, rather like if they had forfeited it. But what we don't see in CVAs at the moment is something which allows a tenant simply to walk away completely from the lease by way of a unilateral termination. And that's quite an important point at the moment, because there may be third parties who are going to be continuing to be liable, particularly guarantors and former tenants.
I'm thinking about sort of that premises becoming vacant. That's not really ideal for landlords in the current climate, because finding replacement tenants who are looking to take on new space must be as challenging as keeping hold of tenants you already have.
Absolutely, and another thing that goes with that is empty rates, and that's a particularly sore point at the moment, a hefty overhead, and it's a thing, conversely, which companies which go into a CVA are aware of, because that's part of the bargain and one of the things which possibly makes it slightly more attractive to a landlord than the alternative.
And that's why I think when we talk about CVAs, it's important to talk about them in the commercial context, which is they are an alternative to administration and administration or liquidation. And whilst no one wants to see an empty store, the question for landlords is ultimately, will the outcome be any different ultimately in administration or liquidation? And so it's not an easy question for landlords, but I think it's important when discussing CVAs to put them in that context.
Absolutely. I think landlords tend to feel that they're caught between a rock and a hard place, and not only that, but basically what they're being given is an involuntary haircut. They've already worked out what the commercial terms are upon which they would accept this occupier, but what they're finding is in fact that they're then being told to discount that whether they like it or not. I think landlords probably also don't like the fact that the word voluntary is in the description of a CVA. it's voluntary to some extent, but if you're part of a 24% who's voted against and the 76% has voted in favour, then as a creditor, the landlord would be bound just by it like everybody else.
In this climate, as we all get used to it, the changed circumstances, it's necessary to find the right balance between those competing interests. So do you think the balance as it stands at the moment is a fair one?
Well, I start from this question, looking ultimately at the CVA is one of the few tools available to a distressed tenant who's looking to reduce its often largest, you know, fixed, inflexible cost, which is its rent. So it's actually the reality there are very few alternatives to the CVA that aren't administration or liquidation. So I start from this by saying CVA should in principle have a benefit, and they should be a positive because they avoid the insolvency route. As to whether the current balance is fair, I think that's quite a difficult question to answer. I think when you look at the process, it's ultimately the tenant who controls the terms of the proposal. The tenant is the one who issues the proposal, and the main control over whether those terms are fair is whether or not the vote itself passes. I think what we have seen is that unless landlords are at the restructuring table negotiating themselves, which generally they don't do, then landlords won't be able to sort of use their commercial leverage to influence those terms, other than in the assessment of whether or not the vote is likely to be passed. So in the absence of that landlord voice at the restructuring table, tenants are continuing to innovate and push the commercial terms they offer. And I think this is driving a perception amongst landlords that every time they receive a CVA, which is a product of the commercial circumstances, every time they receive a CVA, they perceive there to be an incremental, you know, creep in the terms that are being proposed. And I think that's driving a perception amongst some landlords that the balance is maybe out of kilter.
And do you, Matthew, see that there's much prospect of that position changing? And are there any developments in the law in this area that are anticipated that could potentially benefit landlords?
Not at a statutory level, because there's no prospect of any change in the current CVA legislation. In many ways, it turns into a question of policy, and policy-wise, the balance has been struck by the existing statute, whether landlords like it or not. Unfortunately, some of the developments partly are the ones which John is mentioning, for example, where you have the law being pushed out, and every time something new happens which happens to work, then obviously that would then be included in the next CVA, or be quite likely to. And so the direction of travel seems to be outwards in terms of these clauses. There's also rumours of these the type of clause which we've heard about from Next retailer being sought, where tenants are seeking effectively to say that if there is a CVA which allows a rent to be cut in one retailer, say, in a scheme, that they should then have the benefit of that. Obviously, from a landlord's perspective, that's extremely unattractive, because it just means that they're going to be cut with very little control over exactly what happens, for example, if one retailer does turn up going into a CVA. What landlords can actually do, they can obviously monitor exactly how the tenants are performing. Landlords tend to have a lot of information about exactly which firms, which companies are doing well as retailers and which ones aren't. And so they can line up potential issues in advance. And quite often they can be open to agreeing bilateral deals outside of a CVA process or before it. Obviously, one of the things is you don't know that a CVA is necessarily going to be certain until it happens. So landlords have to call it effectively as to whether they think it's worth negotiating. And the other thing that has to happen, we're talking about haircuts, but you don't want to have two of them. So whatever they agree, what they don't want to find is that they've agreed some kind of a deal, that there then is a subsequent CVA, and that they find that their rights, which they've carefully negotiated, are lost, or that they just suffer from another set of discounting. So that is something that they have to keep in mind very carefully when dealing with the legals.
Well, speaking of haircuts, Matthew, there's a interesting case coming up where a number of landlords have come together to challenge, we understand, the Regis Supercuts CVA that was issued in the autumn. Based on the company's US parent's recent filings, it looks like that challenge remains on foot, although we don't currently know when it's due to be heard.
Okay. So I know you're not really in a position to give us any major details about the arguments that each side will be putting forward in this case that you mentioned, the Regis hairdressing case. But on a hypothetical basis, I mean, where do you think the battle lines are likely to be drawn, either in this litigation or future disputes between landlords and retail tenants over CVAs?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question at the moment in the market. And I think the first point to note is this is the second formal challenge that's been filed in 2018. So we obviously had the House of Fraser challenge that was filed and then subsequently withdrawn. And this is now the second challenge that's been filed. And so as a consequence of the number of CVAs being proposed, it looks like landlords' appetite to challenge has increased. I think that's the first thing to note with this challenge. If this challenge goes forward and actually comes before a judge and is heard and isn't settled beforehand, my working assumption, without any particular inside knowledge, is that there will be a number of points in issue, probably distinguishing between particular facts of the Regis CVA and then more general structural issues with how leasehold CVAs are typically structured. So speaking about the Regis CVA itself, from press reports, it appears that the landlords want to scrutinise certain intragroup transfers that took place pre-CVA. Now, the reason they want to do that is because their position might be they think there ought to be value in those transfers that an administrator or liquidator would look to claw back. And if that's the case, they would say actually that asset should be taken into account when calculating the return to those landlords in an administrational CVA, in an administrational liquidation, which sets the baseline as to what those landlords should be offered in a CVA. The vote in Regis itself was close. Mm-hmm. It was only approved by 79% by value of creditors, so only 4% above the required threshold. So it's possible that the landlords may have concerns over the voting arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
It's also possible that landlords may want to run a number of points that they've been looking to test since the modern leasehold CVA was first introduced in 2009. So I would not be surprised if, as part of this challenge, the court is asked to consider a number of more general points as to the structure of these leasehold CVAs. Ultimately, the statutory grounds on which a CVA can be challenged once it's been approved by creditors are very limited.
Mm.
It's essentially three grounds. It's unfair prejudice, it's material irregularity, and it's where there's a problem with how the chair has calculated votes. And so the landlords in this Regis challenge will need to be able to show one of those limited grounds is met in order to be successful with their challenge.
And what kind of guidance do you think would be useful from the High Court, either in this case or if another case ends up being the first one to reach court, or even an appellate court ultimately in this area? And how much do you think it is down to the government to take action to shape the law on retail CVAs?
Well, I think the most useful outcome will be a first instance judge having considered a number of the points that underpin the legal structure of modern CVAs. Going back 10 years to the introduction of the first CVA on which this firm advised, there'd been a number of rumblings from landlords, and I think that's led to a focus, rightly or wrongly, on the nuanced legal debate as to what is or is not unfair prejudice, which is a specific term under the Insolvency Act, what is material irregularity. And I think actually if there is a judgment at first instance that gives some formal judicial commentary on some of the issues, then it may actually help shift the focus of the landlord community from the narrower concept of a formal challenge to actually, well, how can they find themselves a seat at the restructuring table to negotiate and try and negotiate the commercial terms of the proposal before it lands on their doorstep. And I think the consequence of this, and let's just take a world in which the landlords win on every point in the Regis CVA. Let's say it goes ahead and landlords win on every single point. It strikes me as, you never know what a court will say, but it strikes me that ultimately it's possible that a judge, even on finding on every point for landlords, may ultimately signpost the way for future CVAs by other tenants. And so even a victory for landlords in the Regis case may not necessarily result in fewer CVAs, because it may simply show future tenants how to avoid the particular pitfalls that face Regis. And actually, I think when you put it in that context, it shows, well, actually, what's the real control here? Well, the real control would be if landlords can actually find a way to use their negotiating leverage before the proposal is actually issued.
And we mentioned right at the start that there have been yet again even more CVA proposals put forward by major high street names this week. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to ask what you thought the temperature of the market was, and do you anticipate that we're going to carry on seeing more of these? Is this an area that is only going to get more heated in 2019 and beyond?
Well, from the restructuring perspective first, I'll let Matthew with his property litigation hat join in afterwards, but from the restructuring perspective, a CVA is not supposed to be a popular tool. It's supposed to be a compromise that is better than the very bleak outcome in an administrational liquidation. So the fact that CVAs are not popular doesn't necessarily indicate that there's something flawed with the statutory process or the arrangement. And I think the key is that actually the CVA must be a better compromise.
Mm-hmm.
So what's driving CVAs? It's the challenging conditions faced on the high street. And it's the fact that you've got a big fixed cost in rent, that there's no other effective way for a large portfolio to actually manage that and and reduce that rent cost across the piece. Let's say you're a distressed company, you've got headwinds that are, you know, very well publicised at the moment. It's actually very difficult, say you've got 50 stores, to go and negotiate bilateral compromises with 50 landlords. So actually, when you look at the options for reducing your rent roll, a CVA is probably going to remain the most likely tool for doing that. So my view is, as long as the commercial headwinds on the high street remain, we would expect CVAs to continue to prove popular. I go back to the point on the Regis Supercuts challenge. Even if that is settled, I think ultimately there will a challenge will come before a judge that may change the commercial terms being offered, or the legal structure, which therefore has an effect on the commercial terms being offered. I do think that there's an element of, you know, be careful what you wish for from the landlord community in that challenge, because it's not necessarily the case that a judge is going to, you know, reach an outcome that means that CVAs, you know, are stopped forevermore. It's likely that it will just mean that the restructuring industry tweaks how it approaches them. And I think, you know, if you don't believe, and you know, other people have other opinions on the broader commercial market, but if you don't believe the headwinds are going to change for the high street, and that's, you know, we've seen the two CVA proposals which have been launched already this week, and it's only Tuesday. if you don't believe those headwinds are going to change, actually, you know, there is a question as to whether landlords are going to, you know, going to sort of respond to that by trying to exercise their commercial leverage at an earlier stage in the process than they currently do.
Would you agree with that, Matthew?
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a lot to be said for landlords grouping, working out what's in their common interests, and seeking to obtain more leverage. Landlords need to be thinking about their voting rights. Quite often these things turn out to be balanced pretty much on a knife edge, and if landlords are in a position to demonstrate that in fact the amount which is their debt in relation to their status as creditor, then the chances are that they could increase their voting power at the point when the CVA is being decided. At the point when it's being proposed, obviously that has an effect in terms of the way in which the CVA is drafted, because it needs to go through from the company's perspective. So those are important points. Landlords have other things which they need to do and think about really from the very start of their relationship with a solvent tenant, in particular thinking about guarantors, a head co-guarantor. As long as the head co-guarantor itself isn't part of the CVA, the head co-guarantor should be good for the money, and in fact it might be worth thinking about drafting terms which specifically identify that any shortfall from a CVA rent is something that would be recoverable from a guarantor. Things like rent deposits, anything which is a charge, a legal charge, won't be affected by the CVA, whether that's over the relevant property or whether it's over some other property. Trouble with retail is that if it's a rack-rented lease, then the chances are that it doesn't have value pursuant to a charge anyway, but there may be other property where a landlord might want to take a charge. Landlords need to think about voting in their own interests. Possible alliances are obviously one of the ways in which this may go forward, obviously not in a way that would contravene any kind of competition issues, so that's another point. Another thing that has been speculated about has been this idea of a poison pill in circumstances where a CVA is being proposed, then that triggers a provision in a lease, which therefore means that, for example, some concession that was previously granted to the tenant, for example, a rent-free or an incentive or something, becomes repayable, whether you structure that as a loan or something so that it then becomes a repayable loan. All of those things are interesting. There are a couple of problems with them. First of all, we know from the Vivian Westwood case that the law on penalties means that some of those provisions can simply be unenforceable anyway. And secondly, if it's part of a CVA, then the entirety of the lease contract itself, including those poison pill provisions, could be subject to the drafting and the provisions of the CVA. And so, again, those are things which might simply be rendered ineffective by the terms of the CVA itself. So there are lots of things which landlords need to be thinking about in advance and preparing generally for as part of their portfolio planning. And in the context of the actual CVA process itself, clearly there are things which landlords can be doing and thinking about collectively to improve their positions.
And I think it goes very much to what's the problem landlords are trying to solve for here. if you start from the basis that no one particularly likes CVAs, but they'd rather a CVA than a tenant in administration, and that's, you know, for each landlord to assess based on the facts each time as to whether they would rather the tenant in administration rather than the CVA. If you accept that there is a place for the CVA on the high street, the question is then, well, what is the problem? What is the ill you're trying to cure at the moment? And let's say, you know, taking an example, let's say, for example, that's due to, you know, the concern is a lack of information, a lack of information readily shared with the landlord, so the landlords feel they're very much put on the back foot with these proposals. Well, there's nothing to stop landlords, you know, amending, you know, the reporting information, the reporting requirements in leases to actually be provided with that information. You could include that as a contractual provision. That is, though, that's probably going to be a long process to change that. But I think the focus ought to be on, well, what is the ill we're trying to solve here? What's the problem we're trying to solve? And then working back from that. One point Matthew made was a parent company guarantee, and that's great if the parent company is solvent. If it's not solvent, what you'll find is restructuring lawyers will suggest that actually you'll have a CVA of both the tenant and the parent company, and that's, you know, a very established technique. So it may help, but it may not be the answer. And I think that goes back to the ultimate question for landlords, which is they might not necessarily like CVAs, but would they prefer the alternative of a tenant in administration or liquidation?
Sounds like these problems are going to be keeping you busy throughout 2019 and beyond.
Yeah, I think this is a sign of another retail real estate cycle. As John says, I lived through a couple where, in fact, we were all talking and probably complaining about pre-pack administrations. Those had their own issues. You find that the property is occupied by some Phoenix vehicle which has got no assets apart from the stock. And all of those kind of points were kind of very much the character of the times that they were in. The character of the times we're right in now is the CVA. So I can only see that more of them are going to come up during the course of the year.
And if you look at it, what we're seeing, I think, at the moment is probably the third wave, really, of CVAs. You've got the first few that were launched in 2009. There was a flurry of them. Most of those then came back for another round in 2011. And then you had a slight uptick in the market. And then over the last, you know, really end of 2017, 2018, and now in 2019, this is the sort of third wave of CVAs. So they do seem, I think for the reasons we've discussed, they do seem to be here for good reasons. There's a reason why people, why distressed tenants keep using them. And it doesn't seem, if those commercial headwinds are still there, that the CVA will become any less popular.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today to discuss CVAs, and we look forward to hearing from you again in the future, perhaps when Regis is heard or as other developments occur.
Thanks, Jess.